Welcome to the Child Free Wealth Podcast, hosted by Bree and Dr. J, certified financial planner. Here we discuss life and finances as it relates to being child free. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Please consult your advisor before implementing any ideas heard on this podcast.
Hey, Child Free Wealth listeners, we are back talking to Bree about what she's learning on becoming a certified financial planner. And she's finished the second course. We're working through each topic just to show you both what a CFP learns and how it spins or is different for child-free folks. So the second course was actually on insurance planning and risk management. Wow, is that a sleeper? I mean, a fun topic. Bree, what'd you think of the course?
Yeah, it was definitely took a lot of motivation, a lot of external pressure to get through this.
Yeah, when you're reading insurance ones and like, okay, wait, what type of policy? And I'll never use this ever again. And where's this going? And like, oh, you're right. It's tough. I mean, it's one of those like you had to slog through. At least I did.
Yeah, there were certain topics that, you know, I got through really fast and I was like, oh, I know these, easy peasy. And other ones, I'm like, my goodness, could we just be done now? Like, this is enough. And it makes sense why people are often confused about insurance. So after going through it.
Yeah. So let's use a simple example of this and we'll go through different sections. But one of the ones I've been dealing with lately is helping clients through health insurance. What's covered? Is this covered? How does this drug get covered? Do we need a prior authorization? And what's our deductible? And what's a high an HSA? Like, is super confusing. And by the way, HR assumes you can just sign off on that every year when you get your open enrollment.
But there's a lot more to it and it can be rather confusing, especially if you don't know what to look for and know what words mean. Because for us, we know what a lot of things are. And if we need to check something, we know how to search it to find the answer. But if you're not doing that every day, that can be really difficult because you're like, I don't even know where to start.
Or you can get bad advice. And I'll give you an example of this one for health insurance. Just because you have a high deductible healthcare plan does not mean you can get an HSA. There's a maximum out-of-pocket component, which people forget. It's kind of like, well, my deductible is a gajillion dollars, so obviously I can use an HSA. No, not so much. An HSA, by the way, is health savings account. It's different than a FSA, flexible savings account. But it's one of those things where like you think you know the rules, but then when you dive into it, it's different.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much nuance that is often not shared online. And it can be just like we've talked about in other episodes, Roth IRAs. People say, invest in your Roth IRA, but then forget that there's an income limit to that. And a lot of these things have a lot of nuance, but if you're just following and seeing things online, those aren't always talked about. And so those can be really important pieces that need to be considered and brought to light, not just glossed over.
Yeah. And the difference between a certified financial planner and someone selling insurance. Now, by the way, you can sell insurance and have a CFP, but you know, we happen to be advice only planners. We just teach you how to do it, but we don't sell any products. I don't sell any insurance. When you're not selling insurance, it's a different lens you look through. You know, and I have had some people like question CFPs and be like, hey, 20 questions on the test about insurance or something like that. You know, there's not that much covering. No, there's a lot. There's a lot in the course. Can you kind of give people a feeling for what's in the course or what does a CFP learn on insurance?
Yeah. So all of those really long fine print documents you get whenever you sign up for car insurance, I learned how to read those. The stuff that you don't ever look at, you just kind of toss to the side and say, I'll look at it if I need it. So I had to learn how to go through all of that, the different parts of coverages, the different types of coverages, what they all mean. And certain parts of the coverage will cover a certain percent of damage, while another part will be under another coverage. There's lots of letters and numbers to know in there. That is just one thing we covered, but we also went through health insurance, life insurance, disability insurance, long-term care insurance, pretty much every single type of insurance you can think of. I had to go through and read about and take tests over, and it's a lot.
We're going to go through different types of insurance, kind of things you should learn on it. But one of the things that helped me to understand insurance is the concept of assigned risk. And somebody taught me this way before I was CFP. They were trying to sell insurance, so that's kind of why they taught me it. But the concept is you get to choose who takes on the risk for your life or your health insurance or your house or whatever it is. And I'll give you an example of this. Right now, a lot of folks in Florida are having big debates on homeowners insurance because the prices have gotten crazy. I mean, crazy. And the question is, should I take on that risk myself and save paying for it? And that's the question of assigned risk. Who's going to replace the house if it blows away? Now, the reality check is most people cannot afford to replace their house if it blows away. That's it. So you have to buy house insurance. Now, the thing is, your mortgage will require it, but if you've paid off your mortgage, you have a choice. It's up to you. Now, I hate to say it, I'm going to lean pretty heavily on buying home insurance as an example, but you need to figure out what risks you want to retain and what you want to pass off. And there is such a thing as having too much insurance, just as there is a thing as having too little. Bree, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's important to know what exactly you need and what you don't need, because it can be very easy to be sold more insurance than you necessarily need. And that's some of the things they talked about, is don't over-insure. Also, don't under-insure. You want to have just the right amount of coverage. And just knowing that can be difficult. And especially if you're going to talk to somebody, and there are some insurance agents that are really good. I've got some great ones. But then if you get the wrong person, they can also sell you more than you need. So it's about having somebody you can trust to really rely on, but also getting a second opinion as well. So you're not just trusting the word of one person is also important.
Yeah. And you want to ensure the things that are likely to happen that are going to be a big impact on you. The unlikely things you can choose. Like, for example, one of my favorite insurance, by the way, you can get insurance on anything almost. One of my favorite is alien abduction insurance. It actually exists. By the way, it's kind of a joke, but it's an actual insurance policy. You pay in and they'll pay you something like, I forget what it was, like $1 a year for every year you're abducted or something. Reality check, if you're abducted by an alien, I don't know how you're going to claim on that insurance. So there's some issues there, but it's just a silly example of the insurance you can get. And while that sounds like a silly example, there are other things that like people buy every day for insurance that I think are completely silly based on the discussion and what people need. So we're going to go through each of these categories and we're going to quiz Bree on kind of like things to watch out for, things she learned, things that jumped out. And we're going to start with property and casualty insurance. So talk about what property and casualty insurance is and how it fits Chaufrey folks.
Property and casualty insurance covers like your homeowner's insurance, any businesses you have, essentially any property, like what it just sounds like, that's what is covered under that. And having a homeowner's insurance, we've already talked about it, how important it is to be able to replace things if you lose it. This topic was more of a deep dive into understanding there's all these different, what they're called, HOs, ISO HOs of insurance. There's 2, 3, 5, 4, 6, and 8. And knowing what all of those are, what percentage of each is covered under different things like I was talking about earlier, if it's damage to the property or if it's damage to the contents, how it's all going to be paid out. So this was really a deep dive of all the nitty gritty things, and knowing if you have a historical home, it's probably going to be an HO8 because oftentimes that replacement value is going to be more than the market value. And if you have a co-op, knowing which insurance type policy that is, this is where it got quite to be that snooze fest we were mentioning at the beginning.
And I'm going to be transparent. So I took my CFP exam a few years ago, let's call that. And I have no clue which one was an HO what at this point. You know, like I know, for example, condo insurance, which is an HO something. Which HO is that one?
The condo is 6. 2, 3, 5, and 8 are homes.
6 is like, it's a number for a good number for a test is really what that is. The concept of condo insurance is it actually covers anything essentially from the paint in. You know, it doesn't cover the building, but it covers everything in it. Good example of like, different than homeowners insurance, which covers the whole property. We don't have to do homeowners insurance because we have a condo. So the HOA fee, the condo fee covers the other stuff. Yeah, all that. All right. Next section is general business liability. Talk to me about that.
This is for essentially any professional. So if you have a business and, for example, us, errors and omissions, having insurance to protect in case we were ever to make mistakes, somebody got upset, wanted to sue, having that individual insurance, same with malpractice for doctors, nurses, different things like that. It's just the liability is anything that you are responsible for if somebody were to sue you. Having business to cover yourself in the event of that is what this section talked about.
We're a great example. We're in the financial world. You have to have insurance. It's like no way around it. We have $1 million error omission insurance just because we do anything with finance. There's also directors and officers insurance and cyber insurance and other things. There's also business liability for like what happens if somebody slips and falls. Well, I meet with people via Zoom. If you slip and fall in my office, you shouldn't be in there. So that's a separate discussion.
Only you're allowed to do that in your office.
Yeah, exactly. That's workers' comp then. The question on general business liability to you is, so I run a small business, whatever it is. Do I need general business liability?
Can you cover something in case somebody sues you, or can you afford to pay for it?
Yeah. Not only can I afford to pay for it, but what's the likelihood they're going to sue me? You know, so people could sue for anything. If I'm running a cupcake shop and somebody gets sick with my cupcake shop, I'm probably on the hook. Mm-hmm. You know, on the other hand, if I'm cleaning somebody's house as my business and I break something, well, I got to replace that item, but it's less likely like we're going to have lifelong damages from it. It depends on the risk of the business. Yeah, I had somebody making art. Do I need a general business liability for art? I don't know. You know, probably the lowest likelihood of somebody suing you because their art made them sick. I don't know. It becomes a thing, but people also go, well, I'm just running a small business, so I don't need it. Oh, no. You work with one client in a field. I sell one cupcake that makes somebody sick, and I could lose everything.
Yeah, it's a great thing to have in place. I have it on my own. I've always had it since I've had a business. It's just good to have when I was doing social media stuff. It's like, well, you never know what somebody will do. So,
and if you're not in a high risk business, you can get them pretty cheap. There's a common place I use. I'm not going to use names for insurance companies here intentionally, but you know, for most like average business, like $500 for a year. If your business, like if you go to one of these places for errors and omissions insurance and they're like, hey, it's going to be $5,000, they've already looked at your business and gone, that's a high risk business area and you need it. The cheap policies are for the people that are least likely to have a problem. I forget what our E&O insurance, I think it's probably like $7,000 a year, something like that. That's because we deal with finances. I think it's a little more than that.
My marketing policy is $1,200 a year.
Yeah, so. It's based on risk. All right, next up, health insurance.
Love health insurance, which we have a lot of debate in the U.S. whether or not health insurance is good or bad, but we just learned the facts of it and went through. There's different types of health insurance policies, and every one is different. We learned about the Blue Cross Blue Shield, and then also HMO, which is health maintenance organizations, and PPO, preferred provider organizations. Those are all different and mean that whoever you visit is going to be different, and how they're going to cover things are also different, which can be very frustrating if you're not sure who to go to. I'm dealing with some stuff right now and I have an HMO plan, and it's very hard to get somebody to cover what I need done, and not everybody accepts it. Knowing all of these is, I think, even though it was super boring to read through, it's also incredibly useful information to have. So just understanding what type of policy you have, how they're going to cover it, if they're going to cover it right away, or if you have to pay a deductible first, those things are important. Deductible is what you have to pay before your insurance kicks in. So that can be a couple $100s, that can be a few $1,000s. And then you also have the out-of-pocket maximum, which is the amount that you're going to pay your maximum out-of-pocket for health insurance every year, which is typically a few $1,000s as well. Then also the difference, coinsurance. So after you hit your deductible, you still have to keep paying, but then you pay a percentage versus the entire thing. And you keep paying that up until you hit your max out of pocket. That difference there is called the stop loss max, which I know this is very boring information to listen to. I can just see it on your face, Jay. But it is important to know what is covered and what's not covered. That's why people will often say, you know, if you've hit your deductible and you still have medical expenses, just get everything done that you need to, because you're going to hit your max out of pocket more than likely very quickly after that. So then you can save a little bit.
And this is why we have built into our annual client process reviewing people's health insurance. You know, my extreme example, I had somebody literally had 42 choices for their plan. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to spend the next 2 hours reviewing all these plans to figure out which one they should use. And like, I don't know how they expect people who have not had this training to figure out health insurance. I mean, it really is hard. I will say my default choice is go for the good insurance unless you're really lucky and really healthy. And by the way, luck should not go into this, but like seriously, with insurance, it kind of does. You know, like if you're one of those unlucky people, which I have been at times, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, and by the way, I'll ask clients, well, are you a lucky person? And they'll go, no. I'm like, all right, we need the good insurance. And they're like, that's not scientific. I'm like, no, it's not. But that kind of does fit. But I'm one of those defaults to get you the better health insurance, partially because growing up, we didn't have great health insurance. It was big bills. I mean, it was hard on us. So it's my own personal bias. But Bree, after you've read through everything, are you with me on go, you know, start with the hard one, you know, the better health insurance, more expensive? Or are you more like, I don't know, take a chance?
I think it honestly depends on each person, depending, because there are some policies that are very different. Like they're so drastically different. And then other ones are pretty close to the same. So it's a case-by-case basis, and you can't just give a general rule of thumb. But as you age and you have more things going on, it is a good idea to get the better health insurance. When you're younger, yes, you can get away with the not as good health insurance sometimes. Doesn't always work out. It didn't work out for me in my life. So having good health insurance is important, and that can save you money in the long run too.
Yeah, and I don't know. This is one of those, like, if you make a mistake, it costs you hundreds of thousands of dollars by no part of your own. Like, just, you know, you slip and fall and something broken and, you know, you're in PT and all the other stuff. It's just a huge problem. All right. Speaking of you slip and fall and you break stuff, next up is disability and income insurance.
Yeah. Disability income insurance we talk about quite frequently, and it's something that's really important. The likelihood of disability between age 35 and 65 is actually higher than the likelihood of death. So having something to protect your income, because let's say you are, which is for this example, you are dual income, no kids, household, dinks, and one of you passes away. You're going to be very sad, but the other person could potentially live off of one income. This is not going to be a rule for everybody, but many times one person continues to survive even if their partner passes away. However, if the other person becomes disabled, now you have all those medical bills and you've lost an income. So now you're trying to survive with substantially more medical bills on one income. That can be really hard. Having disability insurance, which will continue to provide you part of your income for a certain period of time, it can be for a couple years, it can be a little bit longer than that, it can go to 65. Age 65 as well, will help protect you and keep money coming in every month. So that way you're not struggling to survive off of one income, because disability is more expensive than death.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm one of those, I am okay with a general saying every child-free person at least needs disability insurance, because Social Security will cover you, some of the state programs will, but like they pay like $1,000 or $1,500 a month, like not enough to live off of. And the reason why disability insurance is not as widely accepted is because the companies don't make much money selling it. Like, seriously, that's kind of how that works. One of the ones, and we won't go too far into this, a whole separate chapter of the insurance around taxation. But if you pay for the disability insurance out of pocket, then when you go on claim, like you're like disabled, you're getting the money, it actually is income tax free. It's one of the few things that's income tax free. It's really cool. If your company pays for it, then you have to pay income tax on the way by.
Just note, if you have a small business, do not pay from it with your small business. Pay for it as a person. So that way you can claim it income tax free if you ever need it.
Yep. Next up, child-free folks' favorite topic, long-term care insurance.
Oh, yes. There's no better way to ruin Christmas Eve dinner than facts about long-term care insurance.
You know that from personal experience, it sounds like.
Yeah, may have done that a few days ago. Long-term care insurance, though, is going to be really important as you age and people need long-term care, because when you get older, you're going to need help with activities of daily living. So different things like going to the bathroom, going to the bed, eating, getting dressed, and they're going to need to pay for that. Long-term care currently is $108,000 a year on average, and men will use 2.2 years, a woman use 3.7 years. So having long-term care insurance can help pay for some of those costs as you get older. Otherwise, if you don't have long-term care insurance, you're either going to need to pay for it out of pocket, which can be really expensive because then you're paying that entire bill. However, Medicaid is if you've spent down most of your assets and you don't have very much left. Having long-term care insurance in place can help you decide where you want to go and sometimes get nicer places, because not all the nice places will accept Medicaid. And so by paying for a part of it now, you are essentially prepaying the bill versus paying for it all later. we often will go through this with clients and say you need to have some sort of plan in place for long-term care by the time you're in your mid-40s. And there are different options with long-term care insurance. There's three main factors. It's the elimination period, so how long before the benefits will kick in. And then the benefit period, which is how many years you want. We always say 3 years. And 3 years per person. And if you're a couple, 3 years shared care rider. And then also your maximum daily benefit, which is about $250 a day right now. And then you can also do what is called cost of living adjustment or compounding. So it increases with inflation. And that will help that amount grow what they'll cover later on versus staying at the same right now. Because for me, $250 a day, if I do not take the inflation adjustment, will cover nothing by the time I need long-term care. Whereas for you, it will cover some, but it still won't cover enough.
You trying to say I'm old?
I'm just saying that. This for somebody today.
You just have a lot more years before you're going to need long-term care. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So it's even more important of why I need it to have the inflation adjustment. But it's very, you can't just say I need $250 a day in today's dollars and expect it to work 20, 30, 40 years from now for you. You need to account for that inflation.
Yeah. And by the way, we have a deep dive in long-term care. I did a episode just about this. I had somebody join me, Jill. She had been doing long-term care insurance policies for 14 years. And the day before she retired, I got her to like pick her brain and pull it apart. So watch for that episode because it's there. I'll tell you, it's not a rosy topic. Like, this is not like, hey, let's talk about long-term care. No, it is a little depressing at times, but it's reality check. You know, and if you think the government's going to save you on this one, I don't see it. You know, unless you want to go out of assets and go to Medicaid, it's hard. All right. Next up on your list is life insurance, which they spend a lot of time in the CFP stuff on. Yet for child-free folks, I spend very little. So maybe I got it right. Maybe you got it right. I don't know.
Yeah. So life insurance, there's a couple of different varieties of it, but there's term life insurance, which is you just pay for a period of time, a term. And if the person passes away, the insured, then whoever the beneficiary is receives that payout benefit during that time. But after the period is over, the benefit's no longer there. Then there's also permanent life insurance or whole life. And that's put in place for a person's entire life. So permanent. And that can also have a sort of savings component too. People will often say it's an investment, but I took a picture of this. People often say it's investment, but it specifically says in my class, remember, premiums are not deposits. Insurance is not an investment. So anybody telling you that insurance is an investment is wrong. They're not supposed to be saying that.
And this is where I argue that hybrid or IULs are popular now or other whole life. They keep changing the marketing name for it, but it's the same underlying product. It's like a spork. It's a spoon and a fork put together that does neither job well. And you're buying insurance and investing together, which, by the way, we're not supposed to say it's investing, but that kind of is what they're trying to say. And like you'll hear infinite banking and all this other BS that just, I don't see.
It talked a lot about insurance agents will misguide people and say, you know, you're buying an investment when really you're not supposed to say that because insurance is not an investment. And two, they are not under the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission. So they're not supposed to be talking about investments at all. They're supposed to be talking about insurance, not investments.
We'll hit on insurance people later because, you know, that could be its own topic. It's like getting briefs spun up on fees.
But not quite close.
But go with me with this, Bree. So when I got done with all the life insurance, started looking at it, for child-free folks, I really found two cases where you need life insurance. One is if you have a business, you need to buy each other out. There's a called a buy-sell agreement. So we use life insurance like I die. So gives my spouse money and I leave the business. And the other one is like, if you got like a massive amount of debt that's going to get passed to someone else, which by the way, most debt does not get passed. That's not always the case. But otherwise I'm going, we can skip life insurance.
I think you're a little bit more free on that than I am. I tend to look at people's life and say, you know, if they're living a certain standard of living now, I don't want to drastically cut it for them. And just give the blanket advice, well, you could probably skip it. You need to look at your expenses, look at all that. If you have a mortgage, many times people want to have life insurance in place to pay off the mortgage in case one of them passes, which is totally valid. Because especially if you're getting term policies, I'm not going to advocate for whole or permanent policies ever, but term policies, those are usually rather inexpensive. And so having those on hand can be, in case someone passes, this can be nice to have.
Yeah. And if your employer gives it to you for like $4, I don't care. Like, you know, a lot of employers are like, oh, for $3, you get one times your salary. Whatever. Bothers me is I've seen these people, you know, there's an insurance company, I shall remain nameless, I need to bite my tongue, whose job they say is everyone should have a life insurance policy that is equal to their mortgage payment. And they would literally say, you know, Bree, who's much younger than me, she already proved that today, should have a huge life insurance policy that equals her rent. And I'm like, I'm a bit more absolute on it, and I'm okay with a little more nuance, but I have a feeling you get to the same result in the end. All right. Now, a couple other kind of hodgepodge things you learn in the insurance things. One of these I want to call out because I can never remember how to pronounce the word sometimes. I'm going to try now. It's a viatical settlement. What is that? Like, there's a whole chapter on this in here.
Yeah. This one is if you have a life insurance policy and you want to sell it to somebody else because you are terminally ill. You can sell it to somebody else. You can get the money now. And essentially, they're investing in your death, sort of.
Like, we can't say investing because it's insurance. But yeah, you're the kind of.
Yeah, I mean, the sooner a person dies, the better for them, truly, because they take over paying the premiums and give you money. And then once you pass, they receive your death benefit. They'll just give you some money ahead of time. And what they give you is going to be less than the face value, usually. It's also going to be dependent on how long you're expected to live. So if you're terminally ill and have less than 2 years left to live, if you've got 6 months left to live, you're going to get more money than if you've got 2 years left to live. It's kind of, I don't know. It makes me feel weird. It makes me feel real weird.
They're like, all right, I'm going to buy that life insurance policy and hope that you die earlier. Like, I mean, that literally is what they're doing.
Yeah. One of my friends, he used to work at one of these places, and he goes, every month I'd have to call and see if people were still alive. So I'm like, what? That just...
Oh, that's morbid.
It is.
It's kind of like when somebody told me that there's more money in the death care industry than the healthcare industry. And I was like, what are you talking about? And this person actually like owned cemeteries and plots and stuff, like, in the amount of money they make per square foot. And I'm like, it's just getting so morbid and sad. Like, I'm with you. The viatical settlements, many of the life insurance policies now have an accelerated death benefit to get around this, which is like, if your doctor says you got like less than 12 months to live, we'll give you the money now because we know we're going to pay it to you anyway. So there are ways around it. One of the other kind of weird things in here, there's a chapter on taxation of insurance. And there's some tricks here that I just want to call out. One of my favorite right now is people talk, favorite being in quotes, about IULs, and that's very popular on TikTok. And they're like, you're infinite banking. Well, that's because you put the money in and you're getting your premium back. That's why it's not taxed. You're just getting the money you gave them already. Okay. We're not even going to dive into that one because that one could be its own annoying topic. But the last two chapters are kind of like on how to pick the right policy and the right company. Any key words there or key things you found out?
Yeah. The right policy, you really want to make sure that you're ensuring your first exposure to loss. So what's most likely to be ruined? You're more likely for something to happen to your home than you might be to lose something like a wedding ring. Making sure that's covered because the home is going to be more expensive than the wedding ring. Unless you got a real nice ring. For some people too. Then making sure you identify all your exposures, and you never want to overexpose yourself. So don't leave things uninsured. That could really be big and costly.
Last one was insurance company selection. So how do I know if, like, you know, it's a good company, bad company? Like, a lot of people ask me this about long-term care. Like, listen, it's going to be 40 years before I claim on it. How do I know they're still going to be there to pay?
Yeah, there are different companies that will go ahead and rate the insurance companies. They will review them. They will say, this is a good company. This is probably not a good company, and give them ratings. You want to review some of those different rating structures and see what companies have the highest ratings and for how long. if it's just 1 year, you want to wait a little bit till they have ratings for a little bit longer, for a few years, and see if it's rated well or if it's not rated well. Because better rated companies are going to be ones that are most likely to stick around according to the research that's been done, whereas the lower rated ones might not be around forever.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, insurance is regulated at the state level, and that, you know, there's state kind of like insurance for the insurance, for lack of a better way to say it, to cover it, but doesn't fully cover it. It's kind of weird. It's kind of like you end up with like, I need the brand name insurance with a good rating. And that's kind of your only choice, because the other ones are like, well, I don't know if they're going to pay this claim. Mm-hmm. You know, and the great example of this is when it comes to property and casualty, I got people that have had great experience with a certain company from paying it out and different things, and other people that haven't. Usually you get a feel for like which companies are fighting things and not, and how it works. That's just experience. That's not really in the ratings. You know, one of the great examples of this was an insurance company got sued because what they would do is the day somebody dies, they would shut off the disability payment, but they wouldn't pay out the life insurance until the person fought for it. And I'm like, wait a minute, how does your company know to shut off one side, but it's not willing to pay because they're dead on the other side? Like, that's kind of the scammy stuff that goes on. And by the way, it's not technically illegal in some cases. It's just like, our accounting system sucks, you know, but it does matter what company you work with. All right, Brees, overall insurance, probably a bit of a snoozer. What's the next course you're working on?
It'll be investments.
Well, at least that's more fun.
Yes.
It's funny. People think like CFP or, because yes, we are investment advisor representatives and part of a registered investment advisory firm, that we do investments as our primary thing. It's not all of the education, that's for sure. It's one of six courses. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we will test Bree on investments. That'll at least be a better topic, more fun than insurance. And we'll keep going on what does a CFP learn?
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving a rating or review. We'd love to keep the conversation going. Follow Child Free Wealth on social media or email us at podcast@childfreewealth.com. If you're interested in working together, learn more by visiting our website, www.childfreewealth.com. We'll see you next time.